This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. You're listening to Afternoons with Helen Farmer. It's all about living your best life.
On Dubai Eye 103.8.
You're listening to the Afternoons with Helen Farmer podcast. I'm Helen Farmer. Your chance to maybe catch up on something that you've missed, listen again to some of your best bits and reconnect with experts from around the region and beyond. A focus on health today as we look behind the headlines regarding COVID-19. Should children under the age of 6 be wearing masks and face shields? And if so, how can they do it safely? Dr. Rania, a paediatrician from Circle Care Clinic, had some key advice. Plus, pregnant women getting the vaccine, what do we need to know? And we were inundated with messages from you on the topic of migraines. So many of you suffering. Well, luckily we had an expert live on the line, Dr. Krieger from Mohammed bin Rashid University, and also the Chief of Neuroscience at MediClinic, live to answer your questions and mine about this condition. And are you guilty of listening too much to your inner critic? Do you self-sabotage, whether that is in your health, your weight, your dating, relationships, and even your career? Dr. Chastity O'Connell, mental health counsellor, was there talking about the Goldilocks effect. How can you get it just right? And when it comes to energy healing, I'm a complete novice, so we brought in the expert, a theta energy master, to answer my questions about what it can do for getting rid of those limiting beliefs that we outlined with Dr. Chastity.
Healthy Habits
on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Discussing the latest COVID-19 headlines now with Dr. Rania, paediatrician at Circle Care Clinic, as we really investigate what we need to know. Things, of course, changing all the time, so we're going to the experts. Dr. Rania, how are you this Tuesday afternoon?
I'm fine. How are you, Helen?
I am very well indeed. Although I did do a spinning class earlier on and I've been full of beans after, I've got my kind of post-workout endorphins going, and there could be a little mid-afternoon crash. I'm just warning, the UAE. If the radio waves go quiet, I'm having a little snoozle under my desk. Do you have any celebrity lookalikes? Who do you think you look like, or who do you get told?
Oh, God, when you said that, I was thinking, because I knew you'd ask. I once been told I look like Dana Scully. Remember the X-Files?
Yes, I don't know what her actual actor is.
But I don't know. I couldn't see it, but maybe. I don't know.
She's hot right now.
Yeah.
Love it. Now, I'm really glad we've got you on air today, Dr. Rania, because I feel like there's a lot of questions going around, lots of people checking different sources. So let's get to it. Children under 3 years old should be wearing face shields, and those above 3 should be wearing masks. This is the advice given by Dr. Frida Hosni, the official UAE health spokesperson, in a virtual address on the pandemic to the Ministry of Justice. She added that people should refrain from taking children to crowded areas, especially playgrounds. So first of all, this is extra precaution that parents can choose to do. And if parents choose to do this, we do need to keep a few things in mind to ensure that when our small children wear masks, that they're not doing more harm than good. So what do we need to keep in mind?
Right. I mean, the important thing I think here is to note that this is a recommendation and a suggestion, because masks have been proven to categorically reduce transmission of this virus, of any virus. And if children from the age of 3, if any child of any age can keep a mask on in a hygienic way, it works. But if, like most children, wearing masks occasionally have them, you know, the top half is in their mouth with their nose, nose out of it, or they pull the mask down to, as children do, pick their nose, do something, wipe, and then, or they take it off to basically eat and then put it back on, but not really taking care of the inner surface of the mask and keeping that clean like we all should, then it probably defeats the purpose. So I think the caveat here is, yes, it's a good idea for your child who's over 3 to wear a mask if you take the responsibility to look after it, or if you have an exceptional child who knows how to look after it with those things in mind, which is the hygiene of the inner surface, knowing where to put it down and not continuously have it in the wrong place.
I mean, I've got a 4-year-old. No chance. Absolutely.
Yeah, exactly.
She's
exactly.
A little scruffy nose picker who loses things left, right and centre. Can you explain a little bit about the differences between face shields and face masks? What do you think would lend itself perhaps to a younger wearer?
I think face shields are most likely to be more comfortable to wear for children under six in terms of them not obstructing their mouths and being something they don't potentially have to take on and off. But then again, we've seen these face shields. Most often when a child wears them, they look more horizontal than they do vertical. So again, it ends up defeating the purpose. Mm-hmm. And the difference between the two is a face shield is a physical barrier from a droplet spread. So if someone was to cough right near you, it's like you know, us having a windshield in a car when it rains or when you use your windshield wipers. So if it is in the wrong angle or if it's open at one end, then those droplets do come in. So it's not as good a barrier as a mask. One, if a mask does cover your nose and mouth, but it's a better than nothing barrier. Mm. So I think my advice is for people going through airports or having to go to quite a crowded indoor space where you don't have lots of knowledge or feeling about the people around you and what their COVID status may be. It's then better for that short period of time as you're transiting through places. It is better to have your child in a face shield or a face mask to reduce the likelihood of them catching something or basically inhaling the virus. But on a day by day basis, I find I would rather avoid the crowded places rather than enforce these. Mm. On children if they're unable to look after them properly.
Makes sense. When we flew, my 4-year-old was wearing a mask and it was absolutely, you know, she was fine on the plane. You know, it's amazing the distraction of a cartoon for a couple of hours. Yes. And she just sat wearing it, took it off eating and put it back on again. But yeah, I think you're right. Nice to control the environment and behaviours perhaps. So thank you so, so much for that. The other thing I wanted to address with you is that newly released figures by the KHJ show that 70% now of Dubai's teaching staff have received one or both doses of the COVID-19 vaccine. So great news for the staff, of parents, of course, and students too. Another great move to protect our kids. So presumably this means a lower chance of school staff getting severe COVID and less disruption in school as well. Is this the kind of thing parents should be asking about or when it comes to speaking to their school or even looking for a new school?
I think it's definitely something to discuss. I think going forward, it may not be every school at this moment that has those figures, but going forward, I can imagine that by the beginning of the new school year, we'll be seeing figures in excess of that, especially here, because we are very lucky. We have access to not one, not two, several vaccines. And I think it is a point that 70% is a magic figure because it is what we need to achieve herd immunity or acquired herd immunity. So if 70% of the adult staff population within a school has the vaccine on board, then there's a less likely chance of transmission. So even if a child, because at the moment we're still waiting for childhood COVID vaccines, so if a child was to bring this virus in and was to transmit it to a TA or a teacher, when they're vaccinated, when the majority of them are, the likelihood of them then passing it on to each other or catching it themselves and then transmitting it to another child becomes significantly smaller. It makes the ability of staff to travel home for the school holidays so much easier. You know, quarantine rules may follow and change and make that even more practical. So I think it is a point. I wouldn't necessarily not choose a school at this moment if they don't have that figure yet, because I do believe that by the end of the summer, many of them, if not all of them, will.
Healthy Habits.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Dr. Rania joining us this afternoon, paediatrician at Circle Care Clinic. As we look behind the headlines, take your questions too. And a leading UA health expert has said that the Pfizer-BioNTech COVID-19 vaccine will be available for pregnant women in the next stage of the rollout here in Dubai. And this morning on the Business Breakfast, the guy spoke to Dr. Muna Talak, obstetric and gynecology consultant and CEO of Dubai's Latifa Hospital, elaborating on the situation for women who get pregnant in between their first and second dose of the vaccine. Explained that the advice follows the UK's regulations, and she said a woman in this situation would be able to carry on with her pregnancy safely.
So she just continues her pregnancy very safely. There is no issue at all. Now, I'm sure you're going to say, so what happens to the second dose and when she should get the second dose? This is going to be, inshallah, in our next phase where we will release it specifically for pregnant women. She can postpone the second dose to after 12 weeks. The first 12 weeks is where a baby is developing and wants to avoid that period. This is the UK guideline, by the way. So she can take it after the 12 weeks.
And in recent days, Dubai has expanded the eligibility criteria for the Pfizer vaccination, allowing its administration to women who are breastfeeding, as well as those who are planning to conceive. Dr. Talat said this has encouraged many more to come forward.
Now that we have the vaccine out for so long, there is evidence that there is great protection for those babies that are breastfed, because antibody levels do pass through breast milk to the babies, gives them that extra protection. The recommendation going with international guidelines and with what the colleges, as the American College of OBGYN, Royal College of OBGYN, and other colleges advise, that this category should be offered vaccination.
And she also reassured breastfeeding women that they will be offered vaccinations in line with international guidelines.
There were always requests, by the way, even before we announced for it and opened the door for this. There was always the request, and women were coming forward asking whether they should be vaccinated, whether it's going to affect their babies, and women contemplating pregnancy as well. So queries were out there. And now that we have opened the door, yes, more and more women are coming and are encouraged and feel safe to take the vaccine.
Dr. Talak there, obstetric and gynecology consultant, CEO of Dubai's Latifa Hospital. Dr. Rania from Circle Care Clinic, we've had a message on 4001 saying, I know they've said Pfizer for vaccine for breastfeeding, but I'm worried about the unstudied long-term side effects of this novel and new technology. Would you say maybe Sinopharm would be an okay alternative? What do we know about those potential side effects and alternatives?
Yeah, well, I mean, just in terms of a breastfeeding mum getting a vaccine, if we just look at the very basic science, getting injected by a vaccine into your upper arm, a very minute dose of that vaccine may enter the milk ducts and then enter breast milk, perhaps. We're assuming, we don't know. And then it's ingested by the baby. So the vaccine, the major part of it is a protein, which the baby's stomach would digest and denature. And it's no good to the baby that way, and doesn't actually cause immunity in that way. If it did, we would be drinking it ourselves and not get injected by it. So I think the harm from a mum getting injected by a vaccine and continuing to breastfeed her baby, especially this vaccine where we have been following women, especially in the US ever since the Pfizer vaccines were rolled out, there have been no reported side effects in breastfeeding babies. The benefit is the immunity passed to this baby every day that they're breastfeeding once their mum gets vaccinated. Those antibodies do get absorbed across the gastric and the intestinal sort of cells into the baby's system. And like they do to any other cold or virus or vaccine that the mum has had and has antibodies for. And then the baby's protected. It's the best protection we can give our newborn.
Thank you for that. Okay, much appreciated. I really hope that helps. And looking ahead, it's Eid, of course, approaching. Summer will be upon us before we know it. Lots of rules and regulation changes around travel. So for any families that are looking to head abroad over the summer, any advice for keeping our children safe? What would you say, Dr. Rania, we all need to be aware of?
We all need to be aware that our children are not vaccinated against COVID. I know we always bring it back to COVID because it's sort of the elephant in the room. I think when it comes to travel, because many of us are vaccinated, and some of us have had COVID and know we're in, have antibodies from that as well, we forget that because children aren't offered the vaccines, we almost forget about them. So do remember that, yes, children are less likely to have a severe COVID illness, less likely to have complications, but the chance does exist. And once they're vaccinated, life will be very much back to normal, compared to now, where we're almost there. So I think over the summer, just choose wisely. Think of if you do travel, think of a destination like a home away from home, where at the other end you can apply the same sort of safety measures that you can here, keeping in mind that most places around the world are not as safe as here because far less people use PPE and far less people are vaccinated. Mm-hmm. So, just choose wisely when you think of a destination.
Are you tempted to travel over the summer? Are you having pressures put on you by family members like I am, saying, are you going to be coming over? And I'm like, Mum, I can't make any promises. I just can't. Also, I don't really want to go to the UK right now. What are you thinking, Dr. Rania?
You know what? I am really tempted. And I am tempted just because it's been so long, you know, since we've traveled. I'm tempted to go to the destination you went to recently, the Maldives, because I feel that because every single person 1 year and above gets tested on the way there and the way back, it becomes a much safer journey and a much safer destination. And because on the other end, you are sort of semi-isolated and distant because of the way, you know, it is. So it wouldn't be going to a home country to visit, you know, my in-laws or to, because every other place in the world just seems a little bit more dangerous, and the route there does as well, and the quarantine rules as well get in the way. So I think I am tempted, definitely wasn't tempted last summer, but I am tempted this summer, but with lots of thought, you know, going towards the trip.
Well said indeed. Thank you so much for your time, Dr. Rania. You can be found, of course, at SoCal Care Clinic, and you're fantastic on Instagram at, you know, really breaking down what we need to know. Can you just remind people where they can check you out online, please?
So at Dr. Rania DXB, that's Dr. Rania DXB.
Brilliant. Thank you so much. Stay well and speak soon.
Healthy Habits.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
If you are diabetic or pre-diabetic, just being really careful about your blood sugar levels while fasting. We've got a doctor live on air now to give us some advice. Dr. Iher Beltayeb is consultant endocrinologist at Gargash Hospital, telling us what we need to know at this time of year. Doctor, how are you?
Yeah, fine. Thank you.
Thank you for being with us. I think it's such an important time to be checking in around general health anyway during Ramadan, but we know how prevalent diabetes is here in the region. So I think it's so important to be helping as many people during this time. But why do diabetics need to be especially careful while fasting?
Well, actually, this is a good question. Of course, diabetes is a prevalent disease in this area, and fasting abstinence from water and food for more than maybe 14 hours, and especially in summer. So there is some risk for diabetic patients from fasting. Just to cut the story in short, we have two types of diabetes. Type 1 diabetes, people who are taking insulin, dependent on insulin, and this is complete contraindication to practice fasting. So we don't advise people with insulin type 1 diabetes to be fasting in Ramadan. But the other category, an oral tablet or type 2 diabetes, we may advise them to fasting, but they have, of course, to keep away from outdoor activity in the peak sun exposure for dehydration. To be hydrated, keep hydrated enough water between the time permissible for water after iftar. Also, they have to see their doctor sometimes, maybe some weeks before Ramadan, to receive educational program. Because fasting sometimes can cause risk of hypoglycemia or hyperglycemia during the daytime. We may change some medication to more safer medication. Some kind of insulin type 2 diabetes patient receive, we may go for more friendly insulin with less risk of hypoglycemia.
Now, fasting, of course, is a really personal choice, but it can, of course, be medically dangerous. Can you explain a little bit about what can happen if you don't do it properly or follow doctor's orders? What is hypoglycemia?
Yeah, hypoglycemia means low blood sugar. And low blood sugar, like some guidelines, 70 or 50 by mg. So the patient can experience, and most of diabetic patients who receive medications experience episodes of low blood sugar, like blood, fast heartbeat, tremors, nervousness, and if the patient doesn't receive assistance, maybe go for loss of consciousness. So this is a manifestation of low blood sugar or hypoglycemia.
It can be really, really
even sometimes serious. In some observing fasting, you can have also hyperglycemia, like very high blood sugar as well. So both things we can see in fasting.
Dr. Ihab, with type 1 diabetics who need to inject insulin, when is the best time of day and does it interrupt with that fasting process? Can you explain a little bit around timings, please?
Yeah, as I mentioned, type 1 diabetic and insulin, all guidelines or international medical community, we don't advise those people to do fasting because they have 4 injections per day. One type of insulin should be taken before the food. This is for the food. And there is another one at night, long-lasting insulin, like 24 hours. So by 4 injections, it's very, really difficult to ask them to fast. Mm-hmm. In spite, some of the patients insist to fast. And, of course, we against our advice, but we have to also respect their intention, and we try to help them. Sometimes we reduce a little bit the doses of insulin to match his long fasting hours. Sometimes we advise them to check blood sugar during the day from fasting. And if they found it is low blood sugar, they have to break the fasting and eat immediately. But in general, type 1, we don't recommend to fast.
So you're saying that it can be really useful to just be checking your blood glucose levels more often during the day?
Yes, more often, especially daytime, yes. Especially after noontime, like last 4 or 5 hours of the fasting, prolonged fasting. They have to check, because some patients go for low blood sugar without symptoms. Some patients have hypoglycemia unawareness. Not everyone has the symptoms I mentioned earlier.
And what about those with insulin issues who don't have diabetes, those who might suffer from insulin resistance or might be pre-diabetic? Can you offer some advice there when it comes to fasting safely?
Those guys, we advise them to fast, actually. Mm-hmm. Because, of course, insulin... when insulin is increased after we eat, especially sweet things and all the things. So we notice in fasting, during fasting at the time, insulin were low levels, so it reduced the insulin level. And if the patient doesn't overeating during iftar time, they may lose some weight. And some people reported in Ramadan, they're losing weight. And losing weight will be very helpful in pre-diabetes and insulin resistance as well.
When it comes to reducing weight there, what kind of percentage can be useful for reversing insulin resistance? You know, is it a case of losing 2%? Are you looking to lose, 20 kilos? When, you know, how much do you think can make a difference?
Very good question. Usually, all international or medical community recommend we will see benefit from weight loss for starting from more than 5% of body weight, and we got marvelous results if it is more than 10% of your previous weight.
And when it comes, and I'm not talking about during the Ramadan period, but just I think it's I just want to pick your brains really as an expert. But outside of Ramadan and outside of that fasting period, if someone is pre-diabetic, they are displaying symptoms and blood work of insulin resistance, what kind of food program and activity levels do you recommend for losing weight safely, responsibly, long term, rather than a crash diet and looking to lose 10 kilos in a week?
All right, great question. Yeah, usual lifestyle. And lifestyle have two components, low-caloric diet and physical exercise. We always recommend minimum 30 minutes, 5 days in the week. That's a basic for physical activity. And, of course, patient to follow one of the low-caloric diets with under-registered dietitian just to give advices for the food. And also as a physicians, sometimes we add some medications for pre-diabetes to stop or halting this process. So there is one famous drug we use to stop the diabetes or lacto prevention of diabetes as well. It's well known.
And for anyone who suspects they might be pre-diabetic, what kind of symptoms might they be getting, again, outside of Ramadan and fasting period, that may require them to go and have some investigations done by an endocrinologist such as yourself, Dr. Ihab?
Actually, pre-diabetes be asymptomatic mostly. Mm-hmm. It's not like diabetes. This is the case. This is the danger of pre-diabetes is asymptomatic. You don't have almost symptoms. Of course, we can see some, when examining the patient, we can see some signs show that it's insulin resistance, like a big belly or there is dark coloration in the back of the neck. It's called acanthosis nigricans. It could give us signs this patient may have insulin resistance clinically, but in general, no symptoms. So how we suspicious of the doctor? If I am overweight, most probably we are is insulin resistance, especially if there is a family history. But there is some work, lab work we can mm-hmm. order, notably glucose tolerance test, insulin, we check insulin, A1C, like glucose-related hemoglobin. So there is some work, lab work we can understand.
I read an article just this morning talking about how problematic the BMI measurement can be, that body mass index. And it's been used, really talking about populations rather than individuals for a really long time. And perhaps experts worldwide saying there should or could be an alternative. So some of the suggestions that were being made were things like, basically measuring your waist. And if it's above 37 inches as a man, then that's cause to, be concerned. And 32.5 inches as a woman, you might need to start losing some belly fat and some of the fat around your organs. The other one was a string test. So basically your waist shouldn't be anything more than half your height. So you get a piece of string, see how tall you are, you half it, put around your waist. And if you can't quite reach, then you may need to kind of watch what you're taking on. And of course, you know, there are lots of very sophisticated weighing methods as well. What kind of guidelines do you give for anyone who thinks they might be in an unhealthy weight or shape?
Well, actually, you mentioned two important points. Body mass index is one of the measures, the gold standard measure to check if we are normal weight, overweight, or obese. And even there is classes in obesity, according to BMI, even we can reach to grade 3 obesity or sober obesity. And also waist circumference is very, this is more sensitive toward insulin resistance and pre-diabetes, mm-hmm. because this is when we have abdominal obesity or visceral obesity, what's called belly, this fat, which can increase the insulin resistance and high risk for type 2 diabetes and cardiovascular disease. So again, the guidelines advise weight reduction and lifestyle. Lifestyle and weight reduction. This is a more important treatment. Of course, there is pharmacotherapy. We can use some medication for overweight and obesity being used for some years now and partially successful. For those who have sober obesity, like body mass index more than 40, we go for bariatric surgery, which is surgical treatment for obesity.
Dr. Ihab, thank you so much for your time today. I think it's so important to make sure that everyone feels like they can fast safely, responsibly, and if it is against guidelines, to be doing it really with the supervision of a doctor such as yourself. Stay well, stay healthy just Ramadan, and Ramadan Kareem to you, Dr. Ihab Al-Tayeb from Gargash Hospital.
Healthy Habits
on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
We love bringing you the best experts in the region and beyond, and while they can't be in the studio right now for obvious reasons, getting them on the phone is just fantastic. Migraine is a significant issue around the world and here in the UAE. And many health experts look at a neurological disorder. You know, it's not just a headache. In 2016, migraine was the second highest cause of disability here in the UAE. So to learn more and to answer your questions, Dr. Krieger is joining us, Professor of Neurology at the Mohammed bin Rashid University. He's also the Chief of Neuroscience at Mediclinic Dubai, working at Mediclinic City Hospital. Dr. Krieger, thank you so much for being with us this afternoon. I know you're incredibly busy, so really value your time and your insights. I wanted to start by asking, have you ever had a migraine yourself?
No, Helen. I'm very very lucky in that sense. I don't have any headaches, but I can feel from my many patients with the migraines. Migraine is a disorder that is like a disposition. Like you have a very light tint, and you go into the sun, you get sunburned very easily. And it's if you are of an Arabic tint, for example, you can go in the sun and don't get burned. So it's a little bit like that with migraines. So you have a disposition, and you have it or you don't have it.
And it is, as you say, if you don't get them, you are incredibly lucky. And I think there's a certain level of misconception, misunderstanding about what migraines are, because people who get them will say, it's not just like having a headache. I used to get them. And actually, I'd love to get your take on this, Dr. Derek, because I had them quite severely in my 20s. And I'm certainly not suggesting this as a treatment, but upon having children, I haven't had them since. And I don't know if it was like a hormone balance thing, but they were horrendous. I remember going home from work one day, my boss going, "Oh, H, just go home and chill." I felt nauseous. Just watch some TV, and me trying to explain to him, I cannot watch TV. I cannot have anything bright or light around me. I couldn't pick up my phone. I couldn't read. I couldn't be by a window. I would literally sit with my head in between the sofa cushions trying to escape the pain. So my heart truly goes out to anyone out there who suffers. Can you explain the difference then, neurologically speaking, between a migraine and a headache?
Yeah, you were just hitting the nails on the heads there with your description. This is what I tease out in patients during a visit, and it usually takes me longer than you just offered us all of your symptoms. So one of the things that are very important is these associated symptoms with the headaches, these nausea, this photophobia, where you can't see bright light and where you can't hear loud noises, where you really want to be in a dark room and sleep it off. This is very typical for a migraine. And then the other thing is it's almost exclusively a half-sided headache. So it's on the right side or on the left side, but it's never on both sides at the same time. So migraines, they make up about maybe 40, 45% of the headaches that you see in practice. And then the other large group is the so-called tension headaches. And those are the ones that are not associated with these symptoms of photophobia and nausea and other symptoms that I just mentioned. But they are on both sides and they follow the muscles on your scalp. And this is what they are, the tension headaches. So, and people can have both. They can have normal headaches, which they refer to normal headaches when they are in front of a computer and at the end of the day they get these headaches, or they have these headaches that you were just describing on one side associated with these heavy visceral symptoms.
And can I ask you, you mentioned there a kind of predisposition to some people. What do we know about these people, these unfortunate souls out there? Are there certain groups, certain nationalities, genders, even ages that we need to be aware of?
Well, I don't think we know the answer to this specific question, but what we do know is that it's a disease or a condition that is much more frequent in women than in men. Doesn't mean that men don't get it, and if they get it, it is actually very disabling because they don't know how to suffer that much or that easy.
Hey, I'm glad you said that, not me.
Get your points here, yeah. But in women, it is obviously related to the hormones, in particular the estrogen. So you mentioned that after your pregnancies, you didn't get them anymore. It's probably because your estrogens are a little bit different than they were before. It is not the actual level. It is more the change of a level. For example, many women get it around their menstruation when the level of the estrogens drop. And this drop is a trigger.
Dr. Krieger, as I said, many people getting in touch, and I'm not surprised, to be honest. You mentioned there it's perhaps more common than we realise, around 40% of headaches presenting in clinic actually turning out to be migraines. I want to go to the text line, if you don't mind, and then I'm going to start picking your considerable brains on this topic. Michelle's been in touch saying, I've got my first dose of the vaccine booked for tomorrow, but have a severe migraine today, including facial numbness. Should I cancel or should I go ahead? What do you think?
I see. What doesn't kill you make you stronger. If you really feel bad, you shouldn't go there, because the first vaccine will have some side effects too. So it doesn't make any medical sense to do that. And so I would probably wait a week, get your migraine better under control, and get your vaccine then.
Okay, thank you, Doctor. Hope you feel better soon, Michelle. Jawad's been in touch saying, does this sound like a migraine or something else? Our daughter is 16. She says she's got random flashing lights and blurry vision, and then a headache came on. She was moaning in pain with her headaches, which she says feels like something tightening, and it's all in her forehead, not on the side, like Doctor mentioned. She says she felt sick. She lost vision in one eye temporarily. Appreciate any insights. Very hard, of course, to give diagnosis over the phone, but listening to those symptoms in a 16-year-old girl, what do you think?
Well, what I think is that this is not typical, as you mentioned. It's not a hemicrania. It's not on one side of the head. Then that's a red flag. And you probably want to do some more investigations on your daughter. It may very well turn out to be a migraine, but it's not the typical presentation. So in this case, I would either see a child neurologist, or with 16, you can also see an adult neurologist to get this properly checked out.
Okay, thank you, doctor. I wanted to ask you, is there any truth in Botox helping with migraines? What does the science say?
Well, there is, actually, Helen. This is something that a lot of people prefer to do. And what it does is it gives you a little paralysis of the muscles. And as I mentioned before, the muscles are necessary to produce the tension headache. And the tension headache is sometimes the trigger for the migraine. And so by taking this out, it actually... In a plastically pleasing way, helps the migraine as well.
So could I get it on insurance?
Yes, you can. It depends on the frequency. There's some loopholes that the insurance always build into their policies. But, you know, if you have a very severe migraine, that is not responding to other things, primarily, you are a candidate for Botox. Yes,
okay.
You are.
Okay, good news. What about ASMR to treat migraines? This is autonomous sensory meridian response. Have a listen to this. This is a woman massaging a furry microphone cover. This literally goes on for hours. You can find many examples of this on YouTube and on apps as well. And claims to treat all sorts of different things, from depression, anxiety to migraines. Have you heard of this before, Dr. Krieger?
Quite honestly, no. You wouldn't get it.
There we go. We've got the doctor says no to ASMR. Martin's been in touch saying, do migraines have an effect on our dreams? I dream more vividly when I have migraines, or maybe it's just a coincidence. What do you think to Martin's claim there?
I think there is something to his claim. Migraine is has to do with an abnormal activation of the wiring in the brain. And it may very well be that the abnormal dreams or the intensity of the dreams that he has have something to do with either the premonition of the migraine starting, or sometimes even after the migraines, you can have these abnormal responses. Migraine is a series of events that happen very stereotypically, very similar with each migraine. And the first thing is that you actually notice that the migraine is going to start. It doesn't hit you out of the blue. Mm-hmm. You feel it like, you know, these people who have rheumatism and can tell you that the weather changes. It's the same kind of feeling. And everybody who has migraines knows this. And then there's something little that builds up behind the eye on the one side or the other, which gets worse and worse and worse. And then sometimes you have this flashing, these lights flashing, or geometric patterns appearing, moving slightly in your visual field, followed by this pounding headache behind the eye and the whole hemicrania that really causes you to be nauseated. And you have a lot of associated symptoms we talked about before, like the photophobia and the phonophobia. And when you have done all of this, you have taken all the meds and you slept it out, then in the morning you wake up as if you had a night out. You have this foggy feeling, and that may stay with you for another few hours, sometimes a day. So the whole thing can up to be 2 to 3 days. Mm-hmm. And so one migraine can be debilitating for quite some time.
Absolutely, absolutely couldn't agree more. I remember being in the midst of a migraine and kind of repeating to myself, I will never take a pain-free head for granted ever again. I will never take a pain-free head. You know, you just, it's horrendous when you're in it. So I really do literally feel the pain of anyone who's suffering. Let's talk medication, doctor, because when I was suffering, I had my kind of my grab bag for when I felt a migraine coming on. And it was this magical little kind of cocktail of prescription medication that my doctor had put together. And there was a muscle relaxant in there. There was a medication tablet. And there was also an anti-sickness because I would get nausea. David's been in touch saying, I'm allergic to paracetamol. Previously in Europe was given Migraleave, which is not possible here. What's the alternative? Migral doesn't have any effect. How can we help David?
David is talking about medication for the pain when he has actually gotten the pain. So he's already late in the game. Before he needs to think about taking a painkiller, he can take medications called triptans that he should take whenever he feels that one of those migraines are building up in him. And he can take one or two of those prescription pills during this episode, and then the migraine shouldn't actually happen. If the migraine happens still afterwards, or in an abbreviated or reduced form, then he can take something like Voltaren, which helps very well because it comes in sachets, and you can just put it in water and drink it like an Alka-Seltzer, and it is immediately effective. Most patients do very well with that.
I'm smiling because I've always got 3 sachets in my handbag, and I've got a box of them in my desk at all times. And it is quite amazing because you can feel them kind of fizzing around your brain and just it all just lifting. So yeah, they are. I personally hate the taste, but they are very, very effective indeed. Mark is saying, I take a migraine over the gout in my big toe any day, especially today. It's killing me. Ouch, I've heard that gout is one of the most painful things, so get that foot up, Mark. And a message here, no name on this one, saying, my wife gets migraines whenever she consumes peanuts in any form. Is there any solution to recover from this permanently? Does this sound like a migraine or a different kind of reaction, doctor?
Sounds like she should eat peanuts.
Simple doctor advice. What if it's by accident?
Well, you know, some people, you know, during this phase that I mentioned, this premonitory phase, they not only develop this pain, but they also have some behavioral abnormalities and some cravings sometimes. Mm. So she wants those peanuts as part of a premonitory phase, and it's actually already part of the migraine. It's a little bit like the chicken and the egg question. So she should observe this a little bit more, whether this is actually the trigger or whether this is part of her migraine, when you think of it like this little scene of things that I mentioned to you earlier.
Interesting. Okay, let us know if that helps. Samira's been in touch saying, a daith piercing in my ear worked for me. I've had migraines from the age of 13 onwards. They stopped as soon as I had the piercing done. It's been 4 years and not a migraine since. Can you explain the kind of medicine around that? Where on the ear is that piercing, and have you found it to be effective with other patients?
I don't pierce.
Ah, that's a different...
I haven't heard of this. It's some kind of... I think it's some kind of a coincidence. I don't think the piercing has anything to do with the frequency or the healing of a migraine. I think that's an artifact.
What about alternative therapies such as acupuncture or pressure when it comes to migraines?
This is a different issue. Alternative treatments or complementary medicine like acupuncture does really help. And what it does is it reduces the triggers. Yeah, it works on the triggers. It reduces the likelihood of another migraine to be triggered. And what you have to do is you have to do this on a regular basis in order to have it work on a long-term basis. So it doesn't help for one migraine. It's more like a prevention treatment, a prevention complementary measure that I prescribe a lot.
Okay, good to know. Alex saying, I've had migraines since childhood. With time, I just learned to predict them a day before, which allows me to take the medication. Exactly what you're talking about there, about knowing your triggers, knowing your symptoms, and being able to anticipate them. No name on this one saying, after 4 years of suffering and painkiller addiction that never works, had a nerve blocking procedure for my upper back and neck because my doctor believed the muscle spasms I have there is a trigger. Now on the monthly dose of emgality medication, don't know if I said that right, migraines are not off entirely, but if my pain level is 100%, now it's 65%, which is progress. Any other suggestions, please help. So have you heard about this before, a nerve blocking procedure?
Yeah, this is called an occipital nerve block. The occipital nerve is the nerve that comes out in the back of your head, right there where these muscles are. You can put your finger in there and you can massage this a little bit, and it's a little bit uncomfortable because that's actually where this occipital nerve exits the skull. And if you do a local anesthesia, usually in combination with a little bit of a steroid, local steroid, cortisone, you can actually affect the migraines very, very effectively. It is very helpful, and a lot of patients have occipital neuralgia, for which this is the treatment, and migraines at the same time. So maybe it's like one bullet for two birds.
Sounds good indeed. Mahmoud's asking about green light filters. I've heard of blue light filters that you'd wear to help your eyes and your brain relax before bed. I've never heard of green light filters. Have you, Doctor?
No, I have not heard of that. But, you know, a lot of people, they try different things. And depending on their individual taste, these things can come out. And I'm not against this. I'm also not against the piercing and the other things. Don't get me wrong. It's just that there's no biological evidence behind this.
Is there a cure, Doctor? Is really, I think, what a lot of people are trying to get at this afternoon. Is if you are a sufferer of migraines, and I'm certainly not advocating my solution, which was an accidental solution of having children and the migraines not coming back, but if you are a lifetime sufferer, do you need to be anticipating and living in fear of them until the end of your days?
Yeah, this is not until the end of your days. The migraines, they peak around age 25 to 30 maybe. So in the time of most reproductivity. And so this is related to the hormones, of course. But so that's when they peak. And then later, they get less and less and less. And after menopause in women, they sometimes completely vanish. And so the time when you really have to treat them is when they're really active. And this is in the early years, in the 20s and 30s. Although there are some people who have them all the time. And the problem, and one of the problems, one of your callers already mentioned this, you can actually make it worse when you take too many painkillers and also too many triptans, because there is something called a medication overuse headache, which complicates the issue dramatically and makes it very, very difficult to tease out what you're actually going to do. But when it comes to treatment, there is something new, which is not a cure. You cannot cure a genetic condition. You know, you cannot cure it. It's just, you know, you're being born white or black, so you cannot cure it. You can try to tinker with it, but you cannot cure it. And so cure is the wrong word, and disease is also the wrong word. It's a condition. But what we have found out, and this is like 20 years ago, that there's a particular peptide, a particular transmitter called CGRP, which is very much involved in creating the migraine story that I told you, from premonition all the way to the headache the day after. So all of this is mediated by the CGRP, and if you block the CGRP or its receptor, you can actually get a wonderful response in many of these patients. I have a very good experience with this, and there is different medications available. Not all of them are yet available in the UAE market, but they will be made available because they are so effective that people are actually asking for them. The difference between them is it can be monthly EpiPen type injections that you apply yourself. It can be a 3-monthly infusion, a short infusion, or it can be even oral. Tablets, but you have to take them every day. So the right now the two medications that are approved for this are EpiPen type injections that you apply once a month.
No name on this one, doctor, saying I get migraines on a monthly basis before or during my menstrual cycle. Any suggestions on what to do? And we mentioned the importance of hormones earlier. Presumably, if you know where your cycle is, you could be anticipating it. But what could you do in terms of medications or lifestyle changes to head off that migraine before it starts?
Yeah, this is very, very frequent. And even patients that have migraines all over the place, they have them clustered around the migraine, around the menstruation. So menstruation is a very, very important trigger. There's not really that much that you can do about this, except anticipating it and having these pills that you were talking about earlier in your pocket and taking them as soon as you feel that this thing is building up. And if it's only around your menstruation, if it's just once a month, then it is not worthwhile doing a prevention for it, because it's just not frequently enough. So I think I would just, there's no lifestyle things you can do, because the menstruation is what it is. Taking the pill doesn't make a difference. It's actually dangerous if you think of it medically. So I would just have these triptans, these pills with me in my wallet, and then just go with that.
I wanted to ask you about food, actually, doctor, before we let you get back to clinic. We've had a number of messages asking about supplements and also about food that can be triggered. So fermented food, chocolate, cheese, caffeine, what have your years of experience said around food being triggers for migraines?
Let's start with the supplements, because there is really one supplement that we typically use, and that is magnesium. Magnesium does relax the muscles as well as the vessels, the arteries that are so within the nociceptive perception. So this is a very good thing to do if you have lighter migraines, more infrequent migraines. You might want to just take magnesium over the counter and take that. When it comes to foods that trigger this, a lot of people get triggered by alcohol, and so a lot of patients with migraine are actually abstinent. They don't drink alcohol, so alcohol seems to trigger this. And there's a lot of people who talk about the cheese and peanuts, as we heard, and other things. So it may be, as I said, that this is not a real trigger, but that is the behavioral abnormality that you get some cravings for some certain foods in this premonitory phase before your migraine, and you actually think it triggers it. So you have to explore this in yourself, just taking into account that this could be an option. I'm not aware of any sort of allergic reactions to food that would cause a migraine. And then the glutamate headache, which a lot of people get when they eat in a Chinese restaurant, is a different story.
Okay.
This is not necessarily a migraine. This is just a glutamate-associated headache.
Thank you, doctor. A message from Rowan saying, I had a migraine a few days ago. Across my mind, it could be allergy related. I took some Zyrtec syrup and it seemed to work. It was gone an hour later. Could the Zyrtec have gotten rid of the migraine?
It certainly helps with it.
Okay.
We usually use antihistamines, mm-hmm. And not so much these medications. But antihistamines, anti-allergic medications do help. They help with the nausea and reduce the headache and make you a little bit relaxed. So yes, they're helpful. But the real medications that do help are the triptans, these medications that are prescription medications, and then the ones that I mentioned that you take when you are too late with the triptans and when you have to resort to a painkiller, the sachet ones that Helen uses as well, work best.
Oh, yeah. I'm probably the UAE's number one consumer of Voltfast sachets, closely followed by my husband. We have had so many messages today. It just goes to show what a hot topic this is and how many of you have been suffering from migraines. Dr. Krieger, I cannot thank you enough for your time, your expertise and your no-nonsense advice. And I think the big takeaway is that there are options out there. So please go to the doctor, explore some of your triggers, some medications that can make a difference. And timing is everything. You can find Dr. Krieger. He's the chief of neuroscience at the Mediclinic Dubai, working at Mediclinic City Hospital. Thank you so, so much to you, sir. He's also Professor of Neurology at Mohammed bin Rashid University.
Healthy Habits.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
It is our psychology hour today. So ask yourself this. Do you overanalyze everything to the point of anxiety and insecurity? Do you tell yourself that you cannot do something before you've even tried? Do you constantly criticize and demean yourself? If you've answered yes to this, you might be your own worst enemy, but you don't have to be. You can learn not to do things that sabotage your success. It is unfortunately much easier to be self-critical than to truly love yourself. In fact, psychologists refer to this as negativity bias. But to explain more, we've got Dr. Chastity O'Connell with us, mental health counsellor at the Human Relations Institute and Clinic. Dr. Chastity with us today. And through the power of Microsoft Teams, which we have live in the studio, I can see your gorgeous face and your lovely home. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh my gosh, thank you for having me. And it's so strange, like literally, you are coming into my home right now. So welcome.
Well, I'm glad you...
My bookcase, my chair.
It's lovely. Well, you can't see me, I believe, which is good because I've currently got a rope burn on my face, which is why I'm not having many photos taken right now. So it's a joy to have you with us this afternoon. And we've just been talking about neurology, and I'm curious to get your take on it from a psychological point of view. You know, how common is it for someone to have an inner critic, to be self-sabotaging, to be their own worst enemy?
Oh my gosh, there's so many layers to that, to be their own worst enemy, and then there's self-sabotage, and then inner critic. Well, I think what's important is like we all have, there's this, when we're looking at the inner critic, it's important to think about it in terms of the Goldilocks approach. Too much, of course, you know, compounds depression, anxiety, just makes us feel really miserable. Too little, we're not getting enough feedback. But that just right of being able to sort of hear what may be valid concerns and worries, and we'll unpack what the purpose of the inner critic is and where it comes from. And but that just right, it's like, okay, you're there, you're letting me know that, okay, this is risky. Yes, I don't feel uncomfortable when I'm giving a presentation. Yes, I don't like being the only one going into a party that I don't know anyone there, but I'm still going to go. I'm still going to go and do the things that I care about that are important to me. So in terms of how common is it, we all have them in we all have the inner critic in varying degrees. And that self-sabotage effect, that it's when the inner critic is in overdrive and impairs us from doing the things that are important to us, from living the way that we want to live, from accomplishing tasks. So there's the sort of proactive, or, you know, the sort of productivity element, but then there's also this element around, an overdrive, it makes us miserable, mm-hmm. really deeply unhappy, and prevents us from, and it can look like, interestingly enough, things like procrastination. So the inner critic is so noisy, so loud that we just kind of shut down and we are now binge watching YouTube. So there's a lot of complexity to this inner critic. But
Chastity, I wanted to know, you know, what do we know about why we might self-sabotage? What are we afraid of? What kind of purpose is it trying to serve?
Oh, such a wonderful question, because if we think about what the inner critic does and how it's formed, it's based off of a lot of past experiences. Sometimes you hear folks talk about it is the internalized voice of our parents, but it's also our past experiences. So that really horrible breakup that you had in high school or in college, or that best friend that moved away and left you devastated and trying to navigate a new friend group, that first failure on a test, that stuff sticks, and we feel and we remember, well, and some of it may not be immediately accessible, but we remember, our body remembers those experiences. And so you have the inner critic being created, where it's our alarm system to let us know that, alert, there's danger, alert, you might get hurt, you might get humiliated, you might get shamed, you might have someone break up with you, you might not get this job, you might get fired. So it's there based off of all these past experiences to help keep us safe, to help us not get hurt again.
Comfortable.
And the problem is that when we're living in a way where we're trying to avoid hurt, is that we miss out on a lot of life. Mm-hmm. So that's why I'm saying, like, the right amount of, we need an alarm system. We need someone telling us, you need to back away from that hot pan over there because you got hurt before. But again, when it's super loud, super noisy, we engage in ways that are self-sabotaging.
I understand why someone might fear failure, but why would we fear success, which can be quite common as well?
Well, some of that has to do with this kind of foreboding joy concept of, like, once I get it, I won't be able to keep it. And you might hear flavors of imposter syndrome. It's like, once I get there, they're going to realize I really don't know what I'm doing. I don't deserve to be here. And undoubtedly, in that experience where we're successful, we're going to fail. That's just, it's part of the growth process. You cannot grow without failure. But that failure is feedback and letting us know, hey, we need to kind of strengthen up here, or take a step back here, or adjust our expectations. But failure hurts. It hurts so bad sometimes. Mm-hmm. And so that foreboding joy that I was talking about, that kind of, what if I can't sustain that tempo? What if I get there and, you know, I'm not as good as I think I am? That's a big one. What if I get there and I'm not as good as I think I am? And unfortunately, whenever we go into a new position, in the interim, in the beginning, we are often not as good as we think we are, not as good as we want to be or hope to be or feel like we should be. So there is the inner critic doubling back, saying, well, you should know this. You should be on the ball. You shouldn't have made that mistake. So it is loaded there.
Now, relationship seems to be one area we've had a number of messages on, and I love this from GK, who says, not for me, but for a friend, honest. that old chestnut, saying, my childhood best mate says he wants to settle down, he's 36, but keeps dating women in their early 20s who are clearly rinsing him for expensive weekends away and gifts. It's always ended badly. No idea how to talk to him about this, but why does he keep choosing women who are not good for him? So self-sabotage in relationships. What would you say to GK's mate?
So here's where the inner critic could be playing a role in that more surface or immediate way that person is, you know, selecting these relationships. But I think underneath it, this is where these sort of psychological concepts work together. Underneath it, I would be exploring something called attachment theory. And what this says is that based on our early relationships, and again, it's not deterministic, just because you had it doesn't mean that you can't recover from it. But some of these early relationships that we've experienced fed back to us messages about how we can anticipate getting our needs met. So if I cry, is someone going to feed me, comfort me? If I fall down, is someone going to help soothe? And a lot of those early relationships, we're expecting a caregiver to show us how to do that, how to soothe, and to be comforting, to show us that we're worth something. And so when we're looking at adult relationships, in some ways, we either consciously or subconsciously recreate those earlier relationships. And so in this example from GK where, you know, someone, I want to settle down, but I'm in these relationships that don't bring me to the point of having this sort of intimate, trusting, and by intimate, I mean like really seeing each other, really being deeply connected on a level where I am vulnerable with you. And you are vulnerable with me, and I can hold that, and you can hold that for me. And for some people, that's very terrifying. So that would be a quality of secure attachment, where I have enough self-worth and love and trust in myself that I think I'm good for you, and you are good for me. Well, depending on some of those early relationships, we might think it's not safe to be connected. It's not safe. You know, what if I get hurt? What if they can't meet my needs? And so we end up recreating things that are familiar. It may not be what we say we want, but we don't know how to get off the merry-go-round and say, okay, I am in the same relationship pattern that I've been in for the past decade. But being with someone where I have to be vulnerable and loving and compassionate and receive that from another human being, it's too much. So I'm going to go back to
so
this.
I'm swiping on this 20-year-old chick who has got no plans of settling down for the next 15 years. GK, I hope that's useful. Feel free to forward the podcast on to your friend and let us know what he thinks. Dr. Chatter, we had a message from M before saying, curious how this relates to health and weight. I need to lose 20 kilos, but can't stop, one, buying junk food, two, justifying why I can't be active. Feeling really weak-willed. Other people can do this, so why do I ruin it for myself? Deep down, I want to change, and I'm slightly sick of myself for not being able to do this. I'm 51 and have been like this for years. What do you think M is going up against here?
Sure. First of all, I love that M is bringing up this topic, and especially with regard to weight and disordered eating. And so when we're talking about this sort of cycle of restriction, you know, punitive harshness around, right, you can do this, other people can do it, why can't you do it? What you need to do now is just go on a detox. You know, just do the broth diet or do this diet or restrict your life in some way. And so this isn't necessarily to be against any kind of sort of diet or eating approach in particular. It's more to focus on the way we relate to it. And whenever it feels deeply restrictive, we have a lot of punishing critical language that goes across it, that accompanies it, I should say. And whenever we have that sort of formula, invariably, we can't sustain it. And so we end up in this place of just tense pressure. And because it's not sustainable, you know, a binge may ensue, or, you know, sort of this kind of, well, I've already had this slice of cake, so I might as well have the French fries as well. And because of what is seen as a breach and, you know, this harsh critical perfectionist expectation. And so because of that breach, we're in this place of, see, I can't do it. I can't do anything right. And so we're in this really harsh critical, really harsh cycle where the inner critic is criticizing us into restricting our eating habits in a way that's not sustainable. And then we can't, because it's can't, we can't sustain it, we're going to do something that is negatively evaluated. So, oh, you shouldn't have eaten that. And then because of that, we're going to feel really, really anxious, or, you know, symptoms of anxiety or depression, because, again, once again, we are faced with the reality that we failed. We can't do what normal people have done.
And so the cycle starts again.
And there's amazing research coming out. There's an organization called Obesity Canada that has done some phenomenal work on how do we help bolster people's self-compassion? How do we break this restriction, calorie counting, measuring everything cycle? And this isn't, again, to not, we're not talking about people trying to engage in healthy lifestyle changes. We're talking about these unhelpful patterns. And they're doing some amazing work with self-acceptance, intuitive eating. What is it like to eat forbidden food and deal with what the inner critic bombards you with afterwards, and really rehabilitating people's relationship with food. So what you're describing is so deep, it's so loaded with shame and perfectionism, and it's really, really painful for a lot of people. So thank you so much for bringing that up. And hopefully that gives a little clarity.
It absolutely does, and I'm sure there's lots of people listening who are in that exact same situation, whether it's grabbing something that they have promised themselves they're not going to eat that day, or cancelling a class, or just beating themselves up for not doing what they see elsewhere. Yeah, you're far from alone. So when it comes to making friends with our inner critics, as you alluded to earlier, it's not about silencing. It's about kind of working together and getting that the just right. What would your one big tip be if someone feels like their self-talk is just negative, punishing, and not helping them in any way?
Sure. Well, there's two, and one of them is depending on our own, and it all depends on if it works or not for you. So the first one is challenging, reframing, or looking for evidence. If that inner critic is saying, you're an idiot, where's the evidence that you're an idiot? And if you can really engage with that and say, no, I'm not, I'm actually a really hardworking, intelligent person. I'm just in a point of vulnerability or feeling low about myself right now. And so if that works for you, great. But for some people, challenging reframing gets them into this sort of tennis match of, well, I'm not an idiot because I'm really smart at this. Well, yeah, remember the time that you failed at that? And so it's just this tennis match. So if that's not your jam, then we might be looking at things like self-compassion, acceptance, that kind of acknowledging it, but not fighting it. Sort of that, thank you, mind, for telling me that I'm an idiot. I get it. You know, where, and it's not accepting it, but it's acknowledging that it's there. Because again, it's our alarm system. But rather than fighting, some people find it difficult to fight with it. We can sort of gently imagine that those words are like leaves on a stream, or we can use self-compassion. Yes, I'm feeling vulnerable right now. I feel like I haven't done a good job, and that's okay. I don't have to be perfect. So there's a couple things we can do depending on which works for you.
Chastity, so thank you. That really, really does. And I think that it's something that we all suffer from to varying degrees. So thank you so, so much for your time this afternoon. And as we always say, if you do feel like your problems are getting too much, do know that there are professionals here in Dubai and some amazing support groups who are very much there to help.
Healthy Habits
on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Great to have you with us on this Tuesday afternoon. It is our Psychology Hour. And speaking now to Theta Healing Master Michaela Alhaj. She's practicing at Saver, a beautiful spot in Jumeirah where you can go along and try all sorts of different alternative therapies and wellness practices. And we're kind of going under the skin of some healing therapies this afternoon and trying to understand a little bit more about what it's all about and who they can benefit as well. Michaela, thank you so much for your time this afternoon. I am a complete novice when it comes to alternative therapies and healing as well. I've done some Reiki, which I loved, but I feel like it's a bit of an unknown for many people, and I'd love it if you're able to explain a little bit about what it's all about. So are we okay to start with your background? Can you tell us where your interest came from when it's relating to healing?
Yes. Hi, Helen. First of all, thank you for inviting me. I'm so happy to be with you today. I come from Moldova. It's a small country in Eastern Europe. And when I was about 16 years old, I kept noticing that I am able to take pain away from people, but I was absorbing it in my body. You know, it's not the nicest thing. that's how I came to discover Reiki. Actually, I'm certified in Usui Reiki as well. I was looking for a way to heal, to help people without taking on their pain. And Reiki was the first step in my journey. That's how I became a healer. Little by little, year after year, I tried many healing practices, maybe many therapies, and finally I discovered Theta Healing. What I love about it is that it's not limiting. It encompasses all the other healing practices, everything you can think of. So if you think of hypnosis, Theta Healing works with hypnosis. If you think of past life regression therapy, yes, we work with that. If you think of energy work, like in Reiki, yes, we use that tool as well. It's a extremely big, it's a huge therapy. It's more than just a modality. It's more than just a healing therapy. It's a philosophy. You can live your life according to Theta Healing principles.
Oh, wow.
That are actually very close to Taoist principles as well.
So are you able to explain a little bit about some of the issues that you might address in a typical session? Who could perhaps benefit from spending time with you? And I was going to say with you and your hands, but I don't even know what happens in the session. Do you actually touch clients? How does it work?
You don't really need to touch the client. It's a bit different than Reiki, where you actually have to put the hands on top of the client and do the energy work. In Theta Healing, you can do that over the phone or over Zoom, over Skype. It doesn't matter. You don't have to be there. But in a typical session, you would be next to your client, seated kind of face-to-face, and you would ask the permission of the client. As a practitioner, you would ask the permission to hold their hands. In this way, there is something happening. This human touch, just touching their hand, shows them that you are there for them. You are holding space for them. DNA speaks to DNA. So a simple touch, skin to skin, transmits some information already. So we do this information exchange, but it's not necessary. I do understand that we are in a place where it's not always appropriate to touch a client. It's not necessary in case somebody is uncomfortable with the touch.
That's interesting. And when clients come to you, what are some of the things that they want to address typically, Michaela? What are their concerns?
Well, it depends. Different people come with different issues. Some of them come with physical issues, like physical illnesses and diseases. Other people come with blockages regarding abundance. For example, they keep applying for jobs and they're not able to get a job. Or they have a big project in their mind and they would like to clear the path, to support with energy that project. Some of them have issues like relationship issues. Some of them are not able to have new relationships, and then we can help them to manifest, to find that soulmate they're looking for. Have to work on the relationships they already have, and maybe they have to cut energy cords from past relationships, etc., etc. So pretty much anything you have on your mind, you can come, I'll work with you.
Well, it's interesting because we've been talking this afternoon about being your own worst enemy, about self-sabotage and about limiting beliefs. But maybe this is something that could go hand in hand with overcoming some of the messages we're telling ourselves.
Absolutely. This is what Theta Healing is about. We learn to find our limiting beliefs. We actually clear them. We get rid of them and we make room for new beliefs and for new energies to flow into our life.
Can I ask them, when you need to get into a kind of meditative state, is there anyone that cannot get there? Is there anyone that perhaps couldn't be treated because they can't get into the right headspace, or they're just, their body isn't willing, even if the mind is, or vice versa?
Everybody, absolutely everybody is able to go there. During the session, the practitioner goes into Theta Brain state, and the practitioner takes with him or with her the client as well. And it's actually an amazing thing that is happening right now. It's easier and easier. Not so long ago, a few hundreds of years ago, people were meditating for hours and hours in order to achieve this state of deep meditation. And now it is easy. Anybody can do it. You just need to be guided in the beginning, but then once you learn, once you do it, you can do it for yourself. Theta healing is not the only practice that uses theta brainwave. There are many other practices, and I've seen people, intuitive people, healers who go to learn about this, but I also have seen CEOs of big companies, of multinational companies, that realize that if they make order in their mind and they are in theta brainwave, they can access their inner strength, they can access their intuitive abilities, and then they have a big advantage over everybody else who doesn't have access to that.
So what does it feel like to be then in a theta state? How would you explain it to anyone who hasn't been there or gone there, Michaela?
It's quite simple, actually. Our brain works on certain frequencies. So when now, right now, when I'm talking to you, my brain has some waves inside that their frequency is from about 14 hertz to 28 hertz. Those are beta brain waves. From 7 hertz to 14 hertz, so slower waves, but they're still strong, they're still powerful, are alpha brain waves. Those occur when we imagine something or when we remember something or when we see image behind our eyelids. If we close our eyes and we try to see something like on a screen, those are alpha brain waves. Theta brain waves are slower. They are from 7 hertz to 4 hertz. So they are very slow brain waves. These are the brain waves of deep meditation. After them, from 4 hertz to 0, are our delta brain waves, which are the sleeping brain waves. We have them when we sleep. Being in theta state is being in a state of deep relaxation when you are not quite asleep, but you are not quite awake. You are in between imagination and sleep, somewhere there.
Healthy Habits.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Discussing energy treatments this afternoon in conversation with Michaela, who's a theta healer and master. This is not a substitute for medical treatment. It's a meditation technique dealing with energy levels. But I thought I'd ask her, could she help with my painful knee?
I can help you with sore knee, and I can tell you from now that sore knee and problems in the knees are usually problems related with stepping forward. Mm-hmm. So it might be that you work on a project or you really would like to do something and you don't quite feel like you are allowed to or you can or you are free to do so. Does it resonate with you?
I am very glad we're not on Facebook Live right now because I am nodding along with a massive smile on my face. 100%, 100 million percent. Okay, I need to come and find you at Save It. So tell us a little bit then about what we can expect. How is it working with you working with clients in Save It? How is the program being put together?
I'm so glad. I didn't work with Save It before. I started recently and I have to share. I am so glad and so grateful and so happy that I get to do that. This is easily the most beautiful place, the most beautiful healing place in Dubai. And it allows me to practice fully because it's not only one-to-one sessions that we do. We can do them, of course, they can be scheduled. The one-to-one session is about 1 hour and can be scheduled online and by contacting the reception. But beside that, we do some weekly meditations. Weekly theta healing meditations, and each week we work on a different issue. So I'm taking the clients into theta brainwave, and we are releasing certain energies, and we are downloading other energies. And it's practically an active meditation and a very healing meditation. People feel shifts after just attending one. That happens every Saturday at 6:30 to 7:30. Also, once per month, I'm doing a group healing. Some people don't have access to one-on-one healing because it can be quite expensive for certain people. And then they can come for a group healing, which is a similar healing. So it's also belief work, but in a group setting. And that's much more affordable, as you can imagine.
Michaela, thank you so much for your time today. Really interesting to find out more about what you do as a Theta Healing Master and what's happening at Saver. And yes, you've given me lots to think about. You really, really have. And you can go to saverexperience.com to find out more and indeed to book the sessions that we've been talking about. Thank you for your time. I'm feeling much calmer, even for just a few minutes of chat. So have a wonderful afternoon ahead. Take care.
Thank you so much, Helen.
This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Join the conversation
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
You can tune into Afternoons with me, Helen Farmer, live on Dubai Eye 103.8, Sunday to Thursday between 2 and 5. Don't forget to rate and subscribe to this podcast. It helps other people find us, boost us in the ratings, and you'll get it direct to your phone.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to dubaieye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.